Hello, darlings. It is good to be here with all of you. It's been a minute, and I keep saying I'm going to record more episodes of the podcast and write less, and then I end up writing more and recording fewer episodes, and I just can't seem to make up my mind. You know, sometimes I'm in the mood to run my mouth, and sometimes I'm in the mood to write. There's that old saying that liberals read and conservatives watch TV. And I wonder if that extends to podcasts as well. Do conservatives listen to stuff and liberals prefer to read? So if I'm recording, am I reaching a different audience than if I'm writing? You know, I personally prefer to read than to listen for many things. Not all, but for many. Partly because I'm able to consume information faster that way. A podcast takes me an hour to listen to an hour-long podcast, but I can read the transcript faster than an hour. So since I last recorded, had some exciting stuff. I talked a lot about bat mitzvahs, and very fortunate that my daughter had her bat mitzvah. It went great. It was a blast, and everything was very smooth. She was wonderful in synagogue. She read Torah impeccably. She read the Haftarah impeccably. She was enthusiastic. She delivered a great Devar Torah. That's like a speech explaining that week's Torah portion, and she delivered a great one. And even better, she finished it with a punchline, and the stand-up comic in me was really proud of that. It was a great punchline. It was one that people were quoting back afterwards, and that means that they were listening, they were paying attention. She was up there smiling the whole time. That energy was infectious. And then after the service that evening, we had a party, which was wonderful. It was a dance party. There was a hora. Everyone got up in chairs. And the party was at a place called Lavo. Now, I know I talked a lot about my experience and the difficulty of finding a venue for the party. Remember the place that hosted the burlesque parties? Yeah, that one. Nixed that one pretty quickly. So we did the party at a place called Lavo, which the upstairs is like a, you know, sort of trendy, sceney Italian restaurant. And the basement is a big nightclub space. And the good thing about a nightclub space is you can rent it when it's not nightclub time. And it's got all the accoutrements that you need. And that was one of the things when we looked at venues, some of them, they're just like a white box, right? It's a giant room and you got to bring in everything. The food, the catering, the lights, the sound, all of it, because it's just a blank space. And for some people, that's great, but that's very difficult and expensive. And I wanted plug and play. And so that's the great thing about this is, you know, you get the food from the Italian restaurant upstairs. And because it's a nightclub, it's already got all the AV stuff and a great setup. The sound system is in there. Now, one interesting quirk was that, I don't know if quirk is the right word, but one interesting thing that happened was that there are, in the nightclub space where we had the party, there are these screens on the ceiling that they're not like TV screens, but they're some sort of like LEDs that are meant to show a logo or like, you know, my daughter's name on them or something like that. And about 3 days before the party, the sales rep there messaged us and said that the screens were not working. And so to make it up to us, what they offered was three sprays from the CO2 cannon, which I told our DJ, who, by the way, our DJ was incredible. His name is Aaron Browner. He's a dear friend. He is my former college roommate and a wonderful guy. And he is an incredible event DJ. Weddings, bat mitzvahs, he's as good as they get. So I told him about this, and Aaron said, well, that's kind of weird, like to say you can get three sprays from the cannon. Like, normally you would say, here's a tank of CO2, not you get three sprays. Like, what are they going to have a guy with a stopwatch there measuring it? So anyways, they ended up giving us a full tank. And one of my favorite moments of the party was when my daughter was in the DJ booth, and I've got this great video of her. The DJ is playing Sandstorm by Darude. Do you remember that song? It's from like 2001. Great techno song. And when the bass drops, she starts spraying the crowd with CO2, and everyone is jumping up and down. It's this perfect moment. And it felt fun without being too extravagant. It felt age appropriate. I didn't want a fancy party with caviar and truffles, everything. Not interested. It's just not who I am. I wanted an age-appropriate party to celebrate my daughter's wonderful accomplishment and how hard she worked. And that's what it was. It was like a giant birthday party. I think there were 84 kids there, which consisted of like 77 girls and 7 boys. Totally fine with that, by the way. They were dancing the whole time. They were having fun. They were engaged. They weren't on their fucking cell phones. And the adults who were there, they had a great time too. Or they were lying to me, but it sure seemed like they were having a great time. They were dancing and having a blast. And I could not have asked for more. And I am so proud of my daughter and her accomplishment. To study so hard, to work so hard, to prepare. And I'm felling. She's already eager to read Torah again. She loves being an active member of the synagogue community. I couldn't ask for more. That felt like a major parenting win. And while I'm plugging parenting wins, I got to throw another one out there. My son had a baseball tournament over the weekend. And his team, he's on an incredible travel baseball team. He's very passionate about baseball. And they won the tournament. An exciting walk-off in the championship. They won 6-5. That was super cool. Felt pretty great. I went for a physical a couple of weeks ago. And I was happy with the results. I shouldn't be surprised by that. Like, I'm in pretty good shape. I run a lot. I work out a lot. I eat relatively healthy. I'm not like a fanatic about it. And I could probably lose a couple pounds or whatever. But I mean, I'm in fine shape. I know that. I run 25 to 30 miles a week. I'm doing fine. So I got a cholesterol test. My total cholesterol was 169. Felt great about that. My bad cholesterol, that's the LDL cholesterol, was 96, also in the normal range. Now, I eat a ton of meat. I eat a lot of eggs. I eat probably 5 or 6 eggs a day. I eat meat almost every day. There's some fat in my diet. Not like a crazy high-fat diet, but there's some. Yet my cholesterol was normal. Now, maybe that's genetic. I don't know. My dad had pretty high cholesterol, so like I don't think that's the case. He died pretty young. Maybe it's exercising a lot helps with the cholesterol. Maybe it's that eating cholesterol does not give you high cholesterol. Just as we've talked a lot about on this show, eating fat doesn't make you fat. Eating cholesterol doesn't give you high cholesterol. That's an old myth that your old school cardiologist will tell you, but it's not supported by the research, meaning the idea that eating fat makes you fat or eating cholesterol gives you high cholesterol. That's not supported by the research. It's just not. And I know that all these food companies, all these processed food companies sponsor endless diets and studies and influencers who write books all about how eggs are bad for you or meat is bad for you and you blah, blah. So what? Just because they're trying to get you to eat fucking soybean, plant-based, fake burgers, high in sodium, processed bullshit made by some multi-billion dollar company. No, thank you. Because they want you to become a fat ass so that you can buy Ozempic and have to take Ozempic for the rest of your life for $18,000 a year. Now, don't get me wrong. Ozempic seems like an incredible medication. Basically, like a miracle drug, because there are a lot of people who won't eat healthy. They don't know how to eat healthy. They won't work out. They won't exercise. I know that, like, it's easy to say, oh, just why don't you just, you know, eat healthier or diet or just go for a run. But I also know that that is not something that most people are going to do. They're just not. It's sad. It's unfortunate. They're just not going to do it. So it's wonderful that a miracle drug like Ozempic exists, which has incredible results and people lose weight, and it could probably become the best-selling drug of all time. Whether it's Ozempic or some variant of Ozempic, it'll probably become the best-selling drug of all time. That's amazing. But you will be on this drug for life unless you are willing to make lifestyle changes and to start working out really meaningfully and aggressively. And if you're and you have to be willing to change your diet meaningfully and aggressively. And if not, you're going to be on Ozempic for the rest of your life. So if you're a fatty boom baddie and you can't lose weight because you can't exercise, you can't stop eating, whatever, here's this drug that is for you, and that's wonderful. But let me tell you, over the past few years, as inflation has gone up, eating has gotten expensive. Do you remember at the beginning of this year, there was some avian flu ripping through the chicken farms and they had to like burn 10 billion chickens or some crazy, I'm slightly exaggerating. It was like 100 million chickens had to be incinerated because they all had avian flu. And egg prices went to like nearly $5 a dozen. I'm not talking about for organic fancy eggs, just the regular grade A large eggs went to almost $5 a dozen. That's high, by the way. The average over the last 20 years or so was around $1.50. So $5 a dozen for the average is very, or, you know, for the normal eggs is very high. But I went into Target yesterday, and the eggs were $1.29 a dozen. So why is that? Maybe there was just this short-term supply shock where, you know, they had the avian flu, and they had to cull the chicken herds or whatever, and so now we've bred a lot of chickens and the egg supply is back. Maybe. It's possible. Maybe interest rates are high, and so inflation has gone down, and now we're at a peak in food prices. I think that's also possible. Maybe it's just Target. That's a possibility. You know, Target has been in the news over the past couple weeks. They're getting boycotted by a lot of people right now. If you haven't read about this, Target was selling or is selling bathing suits for trans people. And the idea is it looks like a women's bathing suit, but it has some sort of like very tight straps and a sheath to, quote, hide the bulge. So if you're a, I don't know what you call it now, a pre-op transsexual, is that what you say, transgender? A pre-op transgender, so you've got, you're born a man, you've got a penis, and then you become a woman, and but you haven't removed your penis yet, but you want to wear a women's bathing suit this summer, and you don't want everyone to see the bulge, so you wear this special bathing suit that they were selling at Target with the tight straps. Sure, I don't know. Okay. But the same culture warrior protesters who made a big stink when Bud Light and Dylan Mulvaney got together for one ill-fated moment, they got really upset about this one. And they went nuts and started, you know, the press loves this shit. The Fox News, New York Post crowd, they fucking love this shit because it gives them something to talk about, and it gets, you know, it's a way to scare everyone that, you know, that there's trans people everywhere and they're going to like eat your children or something. Couldn't be more exaggerated at all. So now there's people boycotting Target. And I wonder, maybe Target is trying to lure their customers back in with $1.29 eggs. I don't know. I'm in New York City. I don't think there's like some massive boycott of Target happening in New York City. I don't think anybody really gives a shit here. After I went to Target, by the way, I went to another grocery store called Morton Williams. It's like a small New York City grocery chain. I love it there. I needed more ice cream. Haagen-Dazs. I love Haagen-Dazs. Although it has gone downhill. I think they've been fucking around with the ingredients a little bit. But I went to get Haagen-Dazs, and the big containers, I'm not talking about the ones that they call a pint, but are really 14 ounces. I'm talking about the double-sized ones, which are 28 ounces. They were $6.99. Normally, the small containers are $7.49. Here's the big containers, double size, for less than $7. These are two totally random data points that I have completely cherry-picked, but I'm going to wildly over-extrapolate and make the call right now. Inflation has peaked. Prices have started to stabilize or even come down. Interest rates need to peak and come down. Not dramatically. I think there is going to be a plateau in interest rates, and then they start coming down sooner than you think. This is the inflection point. I am calling it out for you right now. This is not investment advice, but it seems like it's probably a good time to buy bonds. And when you can spot those inflection points, that's the best thing, especially if it's early. And I've called out a couple other ones on this show recently. Another major inflection point that I've called out is the value created by large language models, which I believe will accelerate GDP growth, and it will be as disinflationary as the growth of the internet has been. It's going to create a massive increase in productivity. And we're in the top of the first inning on that one. So here are the two big inflection points I'm calling out for you right now. They both seem pretty bullish to me. I published a piece about 2 weeks ago that got some attention, and I want to talk about it now. And the title of the piece was Quality of Life Violations, a Neglected Necessity. And what I talked about in the piece, it was a written essay on Substack, and what I talked about was how there has been a perceptible shift in the way that what I might call quality of life violations have been enforced or not enforced. So what do I mean by this? It started a long time ago in one direction. Under the administration of Rudy Giuliani and then Mike Bloomberg, New York was very aggressive. The NYPD was very aggressive about enforcing the rules and about enforcing what you might call the quality of life rules. There's a theory called broken windows policing. And the idea behind broken windows policing is that when you allow small problems to go unchecked and you don't fix them and you don't attend to them, they contribute to a sense of disorder. When you see a broken window, it sends a signal that no one cares about that area. And that sends a signal that anything goes. So under Giuliani, they tried something new. If you jumped a subway turnstile, the police grabbed you. And they searched you. And what they found was that the people who were jumping the subway turnstiles were often the same people who had guns, the same people who were committing other crimes. And so if you start enforcing the small rules, you end up policing a lot of the bigger problems too. And if you're going to have the rule, you have to enforce it. Otherwise, don't have the rule. If the rule is a bad one, change the rule. Don't just tell the police to ignore it. So the cops would stop people when they'd, you know, jump the subway turnstile, when they'd pull you over for a traffic offense. The cops would stop people. They'd search people. They'd find a weapon. They'd find out some guy's got a warrant. Then they throw him in jail. And over that time, when those policies were in place, crime declined precipitously in New York. Now, it declined in every major city. Not every major city, but most major cities. And I can't attribute the entire effect to broken windows policing. I've heard a lot of explanations. Stephen Levitt in Freakonomics, his explanation was that crime declined because of Roe versus Wade, which was in 1971, I think. And what that meant was that there were babies who would have been born after 1971, but instead were aborted. And that those aborted babies would have been more likely to commit crime. And so those babies who would have been born in, you know, who would have become adults in like 1991 or something and started committing crimes and getting locked up, they weren't born. And that's why crime started to decline in 1991. I don't know, maybe. There's probably a lot of explanations. There's a lot of variables here. I don't think there's just one. But it seems pretty silly to pretend that this didn't work, to pretend that broken windows policing wasn't a success, to pretend that stop and frisk didn't work. Now, why did this get a bad name? It seems also clear that the outcome wasn't good for black people. Black people were stopped more, they were frisked more, they were locked up more. Why did this happen? Some might say it was because black people were committing more crimes. Others might say it's because the cops were racist, so they wanted to stop black people. I don't know. But stop and frisk was tagged as racist and discriminatory. And when lazy, stupid Bill de Blasio, the worst, most incompetent leader I could imagine, when he became mayor of New York City, he made the cops stop with the stop and frisk. What a fucking buffoon that guy was. Thank God he's gone. And eventually, crime started to go back up. Not immediately. So again, there's probably a lot of different things at play here, but crime started to go back up. And when there was the George Floyd protests and COVID, the police seemed to just check out. I don't know if because they were afraid of being videoed or what, but they just sort of checked out. And now my perception is that a lot of the smaller things, the quality of life things, are not being enforced. I'm not saying that the streets are full of the fentanyl zombies like you have in Philadelphia and some other places. It's not like there are felons preying on the weak and the elderly every time they go outside. New York is still a wonderful place to live. People are investing in the city in a major way. There's construction and investment, and things are good here. But I do perceive that a lot of the small stuff is not getting enforced. The quality of life violations are not getting enforced. There is more jumping of the subway turnstiles. There's more panhandling on the subways. Now, this didn't go so well, I don't know what it was, a month ago, when that guy was panhandling on the subway and somebody, a Marine, held him down and choked him and the guy died. And now the Marine is being charged with second-degree manslaughter. And the usual crowd of the, you know, communist anti-police protesters are out there making a scene saying that this was murder. It's not fucking murder. Now, I don't think it's a good idea to choke someone until they die. Even if he was threatening people on the subway, I don't think choking him to death was a good choice. So I'm not saying I'm in favor of that. But I've been on the subway with crazy fucking people screaming in your face. Yeah, it's scary. I'm a 6 foot tall, 170 something pound white guy. So I'm not usually the one who is the target of the criminals. But I recognize that when there is some guy, some homeless guy who's screaming at you in your face on the fucking subway, and you're stuck there and you can't go anywhere, it's scary as hell. And I feel bad for the guy. That's terrible. He shouldn't be homeless. He shouldn't be on the subway. We pay a lot in tax dollars so that that won't happen. But he was. And he was fucking menacing people, and I've seen it happen a million times before. You know, there was a great essay by Kat Rosenfield for Barry Weiss's Substack that she wrote on May 16th. It was called What Neither Side Gets Right About Jordan Neely's Death. Many of the people who argued vehemently against giving men the benefit of the doubt during Me Too now expect women to shrug off menacing men on the subway. And the idea is that not that long ago, there was this idea that any time a man makes a snarky comment, that's like somehow, I don't know what, literal violence. That's the most unacceptable thing that a woman should have to endure. And yet somehow the same crowd is arguing that women should have to endure some lunatics screaming on the fucking subway. You don't think that's scary? Doesn't mean you got to choke someone to death, but it's not good. So yeah, I think we need to enforce these rules. You know, here's an interesting one that I brought up in my Substack piece. There's a rule in New York City and in most places about the maximum level of tint that a car can have on its windows. There's a certain percentage tint, and beyond that is against the rules. And I can tell you that I see a lot of cars on the streets now, a lot of cars on the road, where the windows are way past that maximum allowed percentage of tint. Why did the cops stop enforcing this? Why did they stop writing tickets for this? Because 20 years ago, they wrote tickets for this. And if you got a ticket for this, maybe it was just a pretext for the cops to pull you over and search your car, but it ain't happening now. And it's an interesting one because I don't see how there could be a racial element to this. Because if your windows are tinted so dark that no one can see in, then you can't accuse the cops of racism for pulling you over. Because they don't know who's driving the car. So unless you tell me that there is some very clear racial segmentation or racial preference where only Black people are tinting their windows dark. I'm not familiar with that. I don't know, but I'm not familiar with that. So unless you tell me that there is some very clear segmentation, I don't see how that could be racist. Why have we stopped enforcing that rule? Why do I see so many more cars that seem to be driving way, way in excess of the speed limit? Why do I see so many more cars that seem to be drag racing on the highways? Cars driving with their high beams on. These are small things. Is there a racial thing here? Can you stack rank racial groups based on who's more likely to drive with their brights on? I don't know. I mean, that'd be an interesting exercise. Open question. Let me know your thoughts. Can you do that? You know, we've talked a lot here about the things that have been legalized over the past several years, behaviors that have been legalized, which my continued point of view is we are going to regret this, that we changed some of these rules, the stuff that if you asked a card-carrying member of the Cato Institute, a libertarian, you know, 25 years ago, what were like their main policy goals? And they would tell you legalizing marijuana was up there. So now we've done that in most places. And I am telling you, I think we're going to regret it. We've legalized gambling in most places. And by the way, if you think we legalized gambling because the libertarians wanted it and not because Steve Wynn or Caesars or MGM was lobbying for it, then I've got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. So we've legalized marijuana in a lot of jurisdictions. We've legalized gambling. I'm sure prostitution will come next because we're just going for the trifecta of sinful behavior. I'm sure that'll be the next big push. And we are going to regret it. Now, this is an example of where we changed the law instead of just not enforcing it. I still think we're going to regret it because there is one of these weed stores on every block now, and you see people sitting outside smoking pot everywhere. And I really believe that this contributes to a negative quality of life standard. Maybe I am just some old fuddy-duddy. I don't know. But it signals a broad degradation in well-being. It sends a signal that anything goes. You know, after the George Floyd protests, there was this defund the police movement, which was maybe the most ill-conceived and idiotic plan. Very catchy slogan, horrible plan. And what's fascinating to me is that this movement was ostensibly to help protect Black people who were, according to some, the victim of unfair policing. And we can crunch the stats and talk about whether that's true or not true. But the reality is that the defund the police movement has caused the most damage in Black communities. The communities that were meant to benefit from it have been damaged the most. It's not the white neighborhoods that had lower crime. They're not defunding the police on the Upper East Side. And so now you're seeing this movement relegated to the dustbin of idiotic historical ideas. You know, the new mayor of Philadelphia just elected, or not going, about to be elected, won the Democratic primary, which means surely going to be the new mayor of Philadelphia. Let's be precise here. Is someone who ran on a campaign of what she called constitutional stop and frisk. Think about that. Philadelphia, a city with a massive crime problem, with one of the worst district attorneys who sowed so much damage, who was in intellectual underpinning of these progressive DAs that screwed up one city after another. And the next mayor ran on a campaign of pro-stop and frisk, a Black woman who ran on a campaign of advocating for stop and frisk policing. It's very clear, as I've been saying for years, it's very clear that these ideas that were advocated by these progressive DAs, I don't know, what are we saying progressive, these fucking communists, these ideas that they advocated don't work. Chesa Boudin and Larry Krasner and all of their cohort, it doesn't work. Their policies don't work, and it is time to step up enforcement of the violations of the crime. It is time. We are going to regret this. We're going to regret all the gambling addicts and the marijuana addicts. And if you are one of those people who thinks that you can't become a marijuana addict, you're just wrong. I know a lot of parents who have become what they call California sober. That's like the trendy thing now, where they give up drinking, but they just smoke pot or take THC edibles all the time. It's usually the moms. It's not the dads who do this California sobriety. Let me tell you something. You're just swapping one drug for another. Maybe it's fewer calories, but you're still fucked up all the time. You're still completely dependent on substances. You're not sober. I've been sober for 22 and a half years. You are not sober when you are smoking pot all the time. Yes, it has different effects on your body than alcohol. They're just different drugs. One's a liquid, one's not. One has a historical fluke of being legal. Whatever. They're all the same shit. Your kids notice it when you smoke pot all the time. They get the signal that that's okay. So yeah, I think that this libertarian movement, which I was a part of for a long time, I think it is a little bit discredited right now. And just as after the Iraq War, it was the neoconservatives who were out of favor, and people said that that movement was discredited and it would never come back, and yeah, whatever. I think we're seeing the same thing with the libertarians who pushed for all of this legalization of stuff. We're seeing it with the people who pushed for the defund the police stuff. That's it for now, everyone. Great being here with all of you. As always, you can find me on Substack, on Twitter. Look me up. Drop a note. Let me know your thoughts, topics you want to hear about, and we'll be back with more soon.